All right, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Daled Amud Aleph by the two dots. Tanur Banan, Gvao Bichovo, Oshelecho Sik Rikon, Lo Yatza Lecherut. So now you have here the restriction against selling an Eved Knani. If you sell the Eved Knani to an Eved Kochavim, there's a Knas that you lose the Eved Knani. He is set free in that transaction. Over here, the Eved Knani is taken in an effective transaction, but not necessarily with the acquiescence of the owner or with his approval. The individual owes money. He did not pledge the slave as collateral for the money, but he does default on the loan. And against his will, the Eved Kochavim shows up and says, I'm taking that Eved as payment for the loan. Or we have this Srikrikron, which is Rashi says, Bishashi Yisrael Mufkarim Lahariga. These individuals kill, and the only way to placate them is to pay them off so that you don't get killed. So he hands him an Eved as a way to placate this killer so that he doesn't lose his life. So again, it's the equivalent of onus because he didn't really have a choice in the matter. It was his life for giving up the Eved Kanani. So in both of those cases, even though they are technically transactions, they're not deemed transactions as far as this penalty of selling to an Eved Kochavim is concerned. Gemara says, is that really true, where he utilizes the Eved Knani as payment for his loan, that that's not considered to be a transaction for the penalty? If the king's men, or these powerful individuals come and confiscate his goren, his silo, or his threshing area, where he has all of his produce from that year, if it's to satisfy an outstanding debt that he has, chayav laser, then he's chayav to take off masrot before they walk off with it, or even after they walk off with it. Im ba'anparot, on the other hand, if it's for anparot, he is patur. What the anparot are, Rashi says over here, have saved, that there's some sort of loss that is generated, and we'll see later on, Rashi says there's this parhang, and this parhang that you make up penalties that you were obligated or debts that you owed. And after they made it up, they'd come and extract the money from you. So this anparot is the extraction of that money that you owe, not that you really owe it, but that they've made up or come up with an excuse that you owe this money. If it's banparot, patur milaser. Over there, you don't have to take masrot because it's clear that you don't really owe the money. So now the Gemara says, shani hotam, deka mishtar shele. Now it's different over there because he is profiting. If you think about the maser, when the goy comes to take, or these individuals come and confiscate the property to pay for the debts that are outstanding, in that case, you owed the money. And now you have to pay those outstanding debts. You're unable to make payment on the debts, so they come and confiscate property for you. When they confiscate the property for you, if they take produce that is tevel, then you are a beneficiary of the fact that they took tevel versus produce that was mi'usar. If the produce was mi'usar, the maser would have been separated out. What would have been left is the chulin. That chulin you could have used to satisfy the loan. On the other hand, they confiscated before you separated out trumot to masrot. And so now you're a beneficiary basically of paying out your loans with trumot to masrot, or in effect, tevel. And so you are profiting from the fact that they are taking this produce rather than produce that was already mi'usar, or paying back the loan like you should. The other case, by the Eved Kanani, when they confiscate the Eved Kanani for the loan, you're not profiting over there because it's at the value of the loan or the outstanding debt that is there. That's one way to express it. The other way to express it is the willingness of this individual to engage in this. In the other case, they were givao b'chovo. They just came and took the Eved Kanani because they wanted payment on the loan. Over here, he is more willing to do this or to make this payment because he benefits from this payment. But the case of the Eved Kanani has no benefit, except for the fact that he satisfied the loan, he doesn't gain anything. Over here, if they confiscate the produce, he gains from it, and therefore he's more willing to have them confiscate the produce, because then he doesn't have to pay the trumot to masrot, and he uses that to repay his debts. So that's the difference as to why, in one case, we say it's a transaction where he's got to pay for the trumot to masrot. The other case, by the Eved, we don't deem it to be a transaction by which he should be penalized for selling him to a non-Jew. Tashma. Damarav Amucher Abdo Leparhang Oved Kochavim Yatzad Cherut. So now Rav says over here, a person who sells his Eved to a Parhang. Now Rashi has said before, these Parhangs are these strong men that go around making up obligations or excuses for extracting money from these individuals. These people extort money, are strongman mafia-like individuals who come and take these avadim. If you sell it to him, it's al chayrut. There, he goes free. Now, Tosafot disagrees with Rashi and says, v'nira de barhang nutel abdo al korcho el shenote en lo damim. This is the friendly mafia. They actually pay for what they take. So they're not just taking away or confiscating property. They are compensating you for the property they took. Obviously, they do it at a discounted rate. They don't give you the exact value over here. So there's a small loss to you. And what the Gemara answers in the end is that what's the difference between this and the cases before? Is Hatam Havale Lefayes Velopies. Over there, he should have paid him off, and he didn't pay him off. Which is that for a small amount of remuneration, this individual would have walked away because his gain is small, at least according to Tosafot. Here he's confiscating the Eved, but he's paying for it. So even if he pays a discounted price, it's really the discount that he's benefiting over here. So just give him the cash of the discount and he'd walk away. The fact that you didn't do that makes you responsible for the sale over here. According to Rashi, it's a little harder to understand, but Rashi, who says that these individuals come and extort money, it sounds like they could be placated with a small amount of cash, and therefore we obligate you to pay that money. Again, when it's a big loss, we're going to say we're not going to obligate the individual here to protect the Eved Kanani from being confiscated when there's huge losses, like the case of Anparot before. On the other hand, here, where he could have easily gotten away from giving up the Eved Kanani for a small amount of money, there we say you should have done that and protected the Eved Kanani. Gufa, Amarav, Amokher Abdo, the Parhang, Oved Kochavim, Yatzal Lecherut. My Havalei the Mevat, what could he have done? The answer that the Gemara gave was, Havalei the Fayes, Velo Pies. Vay Rabbi Yirmia, Mecharo, Lishloshim Yom Mahu. If he sells the Eved Kanani for 30 days, what is the rule there? Tashma, Amarav, Amokher Abdo, the Parhang, Oved Kochavim, Yatzal Lecherut. So the Gemara here assumes that this Parhang is coming as a quasi-government official, and he's basically taking the Eved Kanani into service for the king or service for the political powers. And so that it's only a temporary confiscation, it's not a permanent confiscation. So the Gemara thinks that that should be a proof to the question raised by Rabbi Yirmiyah, which is what happens if you sell the Eved Kanani for a temporary period of time, not a permanent sale. So Gemara brings that case of Rav and says here, by a temporary confiscation, you still lose the Eved, Yetzal Lecherut. Hatam befarhang oved kochavim she'en achuzeret. Now that case, you misunderstood. That's not one of those temporary confiscations. This is one of these permanent confiscations. He's not giving the Eved back, and therefore we can't prove anything from there, because there it's a real transaction, not just simply borrowing him for 30 days. Micharo chutz mimalachto mahu. He sells them excluding his work. What's the din? Chutz min ha-mitzvot mahu. Excluding the mitzvot, what is the din? So over here, it goes back to the fundamental reasons as to why there's a problem of selling an Eved Kanani to an Oved Kochavim. We said before the reason is because he's mafkia oto min ha-mitzvot. He blocks him from doing the mitzvot. Now the question of blocking him from doing the mitzvot, is that because merely he's in the presence or he's owned by the Oved Kochavim, that it's going to be hard for him to do the mitzvot, or he's going to be less likely to do the mitzvot? Or is it the nature of his work as an Eved which prevents him from being able to keep the mitzvot? If he's working for the Oved Kochavim, the Oved Kochavim is going to have him work on Shabbat, and therefore he won't be able to keep Shabbat. So depending on what you think the reason is, will impact on which question is trying to solve different aspects of that issue. So if he sells them chutz mimalachto, he sells them excluding the work, which seemingly then does not block him from keeping the mitzvot. On the other hand, Kufo Kanoi, as Rashi says, he is still given over to the Oved Kochavim. He lives in the Oved Kochavim's house, and he sold them for what's called reproduction rights, that he will marry a Shifcha Kananit, and the Vladot will be his. In that case, his presence in the house of the Oved Kochavim, is that the problem? Or is his problem the Avdut? And that'll make a difference, because here he didn't sell them for the Avdut work, but he is in the presence of the Oved Kochavim. Also here, if he says chutz min ha-mitzvot, if the problem is he is under pressure because of the work, if we exclude the mitzvot from the sale, meaning that he has a right to do mitzvot, maybe that can overcome the deficit of being in the Oved Kochavim's house. Or chutz mi shabbatot v'yamim tovim, mahu. If you exclude Shabbat and Yom Tov from the sale, then does that cure or solve the problem? Because then he can't compel him to work on Shabbat the Yom Tov. Or if he says within the sale, on condition that you don't work him on Shabbat and Yom Tov, does that help enough to relieve him of the pressures of not keeping the Torah and mitzvot? So that's what the Gemara is testing over here. Given the underlying reason for the Kenas, and the reason we don't want you to sell Yovel Kochavim, can these stipulations overcome or solve that problem? If you sell him to Ger Toshav, if you sell him to a Ger Toshav, as Rashi says, is someone who does not worship Avodah Zarah, but eats Nevelot, that is, someone who keeps, according to some, the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, according to Rashi, it's just that he doesn't worship Avodah Zarah, but already this is a big improvement over an Oved Kochavim. This Eben Kananis, they're not going to be compelled to worship Avodah Zarah, so that's already a big step up. And number two is, possibly the Ger Toshav submits to the laws of the land and to the Bate Dinim. If that's the case, maybe he'll follow whatever rules are governing the ownership of this slave. Yisrael Mumar Mahu. You sell him to a Jew, but a Jew who is not necessarily religiously inclined. He doesn't keep the mitzvot. Does the penalty apply in that case? Or does it not apply in that case? Because do we demand that you check out the Yirat Shamayim of every individual you sell him to? Or once he's a Jew, we assume that Jews keep mitzvot and it's okay. Lekuti Mahu. What is the din of selling him to a Kuti? A Kuti in general keeps the mitzvot, but he does not keep Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Michshol. So therefore he doesn't worry about the Eved Kenani doing things that would be Mafkio to Mina Mitzvot. Maybe that lack of caring is enough of a reason to say the penalty is in place. Where it says, Pshot Miyal Chad Chado. We can at least answer one of these questions, which is Ger Toshav Harehu Ko Oved Kochavim. That a Ger Toshav has a din of an Oved Kochavim. So as far as selling him to a Ger Toshav, that's no better than selling him to an Oved Kochavim. Probably is better because there's no Avodah Zarah involved. But as far as his ability to keep the mitzvot, he's no better off with the Ger Toshav than he is with Oved Kochavim. In both cases, he'll be compelled to do things that will be mafkio to min mitzvot, won't allow him to keep the mitzvot, working on Shabbat, working on Yom Tov, as well as the fact that he's present in a household that does not keep mitzvot. So in that case, Ger Toshav and Oved Kochavim are equal. Kuti v'Yisrael Mumar. As far as the Kuti and Yisrael Mumar, over there, Amri lak Oved Kochavim. We have some who say that as a din of an Oved Kochavim. But Amri lak Yisrael. And some say that there is a din of Yisrael. And again, so we spoke about what are the two tzadim in each of these cases. Do we look at the fact that he's a Jew and that's enough? We don't have to go checking out his religious lifestyle when you sell the Eved to the individual. Or do we say, if the guy's in Yisrael Mumar, you're putting him in a predicament, this Eved Kenani, no better than an Oved Kochavim. And the Kuti, the same thing. Do we worry about his failure to care about other people's Shemirat HaMitzvot? Or do we say that this person in general is a Jew and keeps the mitzvot and will enable this Eved Kenani to keep the mitzvot? And here we had the machloket in conclusion as to whether they are like Ovdei Kochavim or whether they have a din of Israel. Alright, so now Gemara says, Boimine mi Rabbi Ami. They pose this question to Rabbi Ami. Eved shepil etzmo de gaisot, vein rabo yochol lehotzio, lo bedine Israel, velo bedine Ovdei Kochavim, mahu shiitole damav. So this is probably a common predicament that the Jews found themselves in. They're querying Rabbi Ami about the situation, which is the Eved was taken. The Eved threw himself to the Gaisot, which was that he allowed himself to be taken into captivity, or he was using this as a way to run away, obviously against the will of the master. But now the master has no way to get this Eved back. He can't go through the Jewish court system, because it seems like they don't have enough jurisdiction to do this, and the non-Jewish court system is not really interested in helping him out in this situation. So neither of them is either empowered or willing to deal with this situation. So he's in a predicament where he will not get the slave back. Can he then take payment for the slave? He's going to lose money here. So if he's going to lose money, maybe he should effectively allow a sale to go through, because at least then he gets the cash for the Eved and doesn't suffer the loss of the Eved. Or do we say that it's illegal to sell an Eved Kenani, and this will be under that restriction of selling an Eved Kenani? And so, again, the other parties are willing to pay for him because they didn't necessarily want to steal him, but they are happy to have him and pay some sort of discounted rate, but at least Israel can recover some money then, if he gets the money back. Samalei Rabbi Yirmiya, the Rabbi Zrika, Pok Ayin B'michilteich. So go out, Rashi says, go look at your Mishnayot, go review your learning and see if you see anything about that. Others, the Michilta in general is the Midrashei Halacha and Shemot. So that would be go look in your Midrashei Halacha to see what you have there. Nafak Dak Veshkach. Went in and he found it that there's a bright to the Tanya. Mocher Beito Ovid Kochavim, Tamav Asurim. Person who sells his house to a non-Jew, the money is considered to be Asur. This is an Ovid Kochavim in Eretz Yisrael. You're selling him his bayit where there's a restriction on giving them a hold on the land in Eretz Yisrael because of Loti Chaneim. Loti Ten Lem Chanaya Bakarka. You can't give them a hold in ownership in the land. Selling the house is problematic. And if you do sell the house, the money that you collect for selling that house is a sore because you violated that din d'oraita of not giving them chanayah b'karka. Right, right. So here, some sort of strongman, mafia individual comes along and confiscates this individual's house, throws him out of his house. And now the owners can't get it back and through legal channels, can't go through the Jewish court system, the non-Jewish court system, mutar li tola damav. You're allowed to take the money as compensation for the loss of the house, the kotev umaleb erko chalehem, and you can go into the non-Jewish court system to sign and verify or ratify the contracts. It's equivalent of hashavat aveda. Here you're going to lose. So why shouldn't you at least get the money back that you're going to lose? It's matzil mi'adam. You're saving. Anything you can get back is money that was otherwise lost or value otherwise lost. The house is gone. We're not going to get the house back. So at least you may as well get compensation for the house rather than giving up everything. So here are the same thing you would say with regards to the Eved Kenani, the same way like by the house we say that you're permitted to do this even though it's a sur to sell the house. So too by the Eved, once it's a fait accompli that the Eved is gone, then you may as well get money for him being gone. There's some value to you. Why should you have to give up all the value just because these people are acting obviously inappropriately and just confiscating or taking property, or that the Eved Kenani threw himself out so that he gets out of this predicament of being enslaved to a Jew. Now, why you're allowed to be maleh ba'arko chalehem, Rashi over here says, despite the fact that it gives them chashivut, despite the fact that in going into their court system and getting the document signed, that basically gives a stamp of approval to their court system, and their court system, which is connected probably to Avodah Zarah, in addition to that, is some sort of admission in an implicit manner that their way is the right way, or giving kavod to their Avodah Zarah or their methodology. Despite that fact, we allow you to do it, kimatzil bi'adam. Tosafot, on the other hand, says that that's not the reason. The reason that you possibly would not have been allowed to go into their court system is because that is the equivalent of approving of the sale. Meaning that here you're compelled to deal with the sale because they confiscated the property, and now you want money back. But if you go into the court system, it starts to look like not that you are an unwilling participant, but rather you are a willing participant. You're signing contracts. You're getting them approved in the court system. So it looks more like a willing sale or an official sale rather than a forced sale. Despite that fact, we allow you to do it because kimatzil mi'adam. That's the only way you're going to get your money out of this situation. V'dilma hani mile bayit. Kevin de lo sagile bo bayit lo ate lizvune. Maybe a house is different. Because over there, the individual confiscated the house is not so readily going to give it up because he needs a place to live. Everybody needs a place to live. And this is now his place to live. You're not going to buy him or force him out of this house because he's not interested in taking money. He was interested in a place to live. Aval avdo desagile below avdo. When it comes to a slave, not everybody needs a slave. And he doesn't have to have a slave. Ata lezvune alone. Maybe he would be willing to sell it. Or maybe not. There is no difference. So Gemara proposes at least that there might be a difference between a bayit and an eved, which is the likelihood of ever ransoming the house back out is very low. For that reason, we allow the sale to go through because there's no other way to solve this problem or to rectify this situation. On the other hand, with regards to the Eved, maybe there it's a little different. Maybe there he'd be willing to give the Eved back for some sort of remuneration, which would then bring the Eved back instead of having him hold on to the Eved and get payment for the Eved. Now, even though there'll be a loss of money, I mean, not only are you not getting paid for the Eved, you have to pay to get him back. Now, over here, he ran away. So it's not the other person's fault necessarily that took him captive. He ran into captivity. He gave himself up into this captivity. So how much obligation there is on the owner, we'll discuss in a second. But at least here, maybe the owner has the ability or the possibility of getting it back, and we will obligate him to get it back. And therefore, he cannot engage in a sale of the Eved, because we will deem that as being a transaction or a willing transaction. Shesalach lo Rabbi Ami, mine Ami Bar Natan. So Rabbi Ami sends back to them, from the desk of Ami Bar Natan, Torah Yotze the Chol Yisrael. Torah goes out to all of Klal Yisrael, meaning that I send answers or shutim to all of Klal Yisrael. This is my Torah that's coming to you. Eved shepil atzmo legaisot. This Eved that willingly throws himself into captivity. Vein rabo yechol otzio lo b'dinei Yisrael, v'lo b'dinei obdei kochavim. The master's unable through the legal channels to get him back. Mutar li tol et damav. You can take the money in lieu of the Eved. V'kotev amala v'akot shel obdei kochavim. He's allowed to then go into their official channels and get the document signed and verified. Mipnei shehu k'matzil miyadam. It is meshiva veda, in a sense. You are getting lost money. There's no chance you're getting the property back. You may as well get some sort of payment back in lieu of the property. Otherwise, you're going to lose the property and the money. So you may as well take the money in this case. And so Rabbi Ami says that it's equivalent to the case of bayit, and in cases where you're compelled into these situations and you're not a willing seller of the Eved, that if that's your only choice for you to get anything out of this, then we tell you, take the money, because otherwise you're going to get nothing. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Omecher avdo lo ovdei kochavim, person who sells an Eved to an ovdei kochavim, konsinoto ad mea bidamav. We penalize him up to 100 times his value. Now, either that means that to redeem him up to 100 times of his value, or to put into the penalty fund, which is a fund then will be used for the public needs to redeem captives, that we make you put in up to 100 times of his value in order to facilitate the redemption of these individuals who are then in the hands of Ovdei Kochavim. So Gemara wants to know, Dafka or Lav Dafka? How literally do we take this 100 times or not? The way Rashi learns it is it Dafka, meaning that you literally have to give 100 times, or Lav Dafka is a Guzma? It's an exaggeration. Just means a lot of money. Doesn't literally mean 100 times, but just a lot. According to Rashi, is that the literal amount that we go up to 100 literally? Or does that just mean we go up to large numbers, but not literally have to get to 100? Or the way that Tosafot learns it is the other way around. Is it dafka, meaning only up to 100 times, but not more than that? Or lav dafka means doesn't matter. 100 times is just an indication of how big it could get, but if it goes further, you still have to pay, meaning at any price. So the question of which way the lav dafka goes here, Rashi sees the dafka as a cap, and the lav dafka being low. Tosafot sees the dafka being a minimum, and the lav dafka being even above that value. Tashma, damaresh lokish, hamucher behema gasa lo'ovid kochavim. Person who sells a behema gasa, which is a heavy-duty behema who does work in the field, you're not allowed to sell him to an ovid kochavim. That is a din in Masechet Avodah Zarah, because we're afraid if you sell him to them, you also rent or lend it to them. And if you rent or lend it to them, you have a problem of them working on Shabbat and Yom Tov when it's your requirement to ensure that your behema rests on those days. But when you rent it out to them, they're not going to have the behema rest on those days. So there's a restriction against selling behemot kasot to an ovid kochavim. Atus, we don't want you engaging in transactions with them, because if you sell it, you also end up renting it to them. So they prevented any transactions with behemot gasot to avoid this problem of renting or lending it to them. Or again, in cases where the transaction, he sends the behema over and the payment of the transaction only closed later on and he's working for the Jew until that point, so the behema really belongs to the Jew when it's working on Shabbat. Whatever the reason is that it's problematic, there was a gzerah that you couldn't sell these behemot gasot to the Oved Kochavim. Now, there he says, konsinoto ad asara bidamea. In order to fine you for violating this din chachamim, we require you to buy it back for up to 10 times its value. So the way Rashi reads this is that, well, if there you're penalizing him 10 times his value, that's an indication that we can't take 100 literally, because over here it says 10. If we're always konis you when you violate a din of the chachamim, then there should be the same example. It should be 100 times or 10 times. You shouldn't change the number. The fact that it changes the number here to 10 shows you that 10 is the more likely answer, and 100 is just a guzma, it's just an exaggeration. Or for the Balei HaTosafot, the other way around, which is that You see here that it's 10 times, and we can't take that literally because we know by an evid it's 100 times. And so that means that that cap is just telling you it's a lot of money, but not telling you that it's a real cap. You can go above it because we see by the evidence 100 times. Maybe there's a difference between avadim and behemot. How can you draw equivalence between them? There might be a reason for praying 100 times and 110 times. Not because every time you violate the words of the chachamim, there's a knas. And here we see there's a difference in the numbers, so that shows you something. But rather, the cases are completely different. By the Eved, every day, you're causing him to lose out on the mitzvot. Therefore, we have a higher demand of kenas in order to free him. Versus the Behem Agasa, which is simply a violation of the Takanat Chachamim or the Gzerat Chachamim. But on the other hand, once the Behemah is in the Goy's hands, there's no longer any violation because it's owned by the Goy at that point in time. By the Eved, every day that goes by, he is not keeping the mitzvot. Therefore, the violation continues. And maybe there will demand you pay more money to redeem him. So drawing that equation between Beima Gasa and the Ovei Kochavim is not a fair equation. Vigadam, right? Some say it this way. Amar Yishuv ben Levi, Amocher Abdol Ovei Kochavim, Konsim Oto Ad Asara B'damav. For there, you penalize him 10 times his value. Davka? Olav Davka, again, same question. According to Rashi, again, Davka means 10 times, literally. Lav Davka means, that's just the Derech Kuzma, which just means a lot of money, but it can be, maybe it's not, you have to get to 10 times, maybe make you pay a lot of money. Or, according to Tosafot, 10 times the maximum, or can you go above that level? Tashma, Damar Ish Lakish, Mecher Beima Gas, Lovei Kochavim, Konsino Toad, Mea Bidamea. By a case, when you sell a Beima Gas, Lovei Kochavim, we can penalize you up to 100 times its value. Here, the numbers are the other way around, but the proof is the same thing. Which is that you can't take anything literally over here, because one case is saying 10 times, one saying 100 times. So the Gemara says, shiny Eved, the Loha Darle. So the Gemara says, by the Eved, he's not coming back. Once he's returned, this Eved is going free. This guy violated the Takanat Chachamim, not to sell to an Ovei Kochavim. He sold to the Ovei Kochavim. The penalty for that is Yatzad Lecherut. The Eved is going to be free. So even if we demand him to redeem him and pay above his value, we're going to limit the amount of money you pay because he is not going to get the Eved back. And so up to a certain point, we say pay for it. After that point, we say forget it. Whereas by the Behema Gasa, we case there, there's no penalty that it's Yetzal Lecherut, quote unquote. If he redeems the Behema Gasa, it's going to come back to him. So he has benefit from the fact that he redeems the Behema Gasa. And therefore, we'd expect him to pay more money for the Behema Gasa than the Eved, because of the fact that by the Behema Gasa he will get it back, by the Eved he won't get it back. You might ask the obvious question, which is, Ela Behema time am I? So do you tell me the reason why Behema pays 100 times versus the Eved that pays 10 times is because Behema Gasa comes back? Mishum dahajule? So if that's the case, he's going to get a return, lekansei tfeichad. Then the only thing you should do in excess of an Eved is one more value of the Behema. Which is say, if you're willing to pay 10 times for the Eved, even though you're not getting it back, then for Behema, you should be willing to pay 11 times. 10 times is the penalty, and one more time because you're actually getting the Behema back, which is the underlying value of the Behema. So if you're right about that distinction, then the Behema should have been 11 times, and the Eved should have been 10 times. Not the difference between 10 times and 100 times. That's ridiculous that he has to pay 100 times for Behema because he's getting it back, and only pays 10 times for the Eved that he's not getting it back. From 11 times to 100 times, all of that additional payment is all because you're getting the Behema back. Behema is not worth that much. It's worth one times more. So that should be 11 times his value, not 10 times his value. Ella, Eved milta de lo shchicha. This case of Eved is an unusual scenario. Milta de lo shchicha lo gozeri ba rabbanan. In cases that are unusual, the rabbanan were not gozer in terms of the knas. And that's why there, they only went up to 10 times. Rather than going up to the 100 times. So since it's unusual that he will sell him to an Ovei Kochavim, the penalty there was much more limited than a penalty where selling Behemot Gasot was a regular occurrence or something that you could see happening all the time despite the Takanat Chachamim. So to reinforce their Takana, they made the penalties much bigger on the Behemot Gasa versus the Eved. I would say also that the underlying value of the Behemot Gasa was probably lower than the Eved Kanani. And therefore, 100 times the Behema may be equal in value to 10 times the Eved Kedani, because Eved Kedani is probably worth more money than the Behema Gasa. And so if you look on in terms of a total value, there probably is some sort of equation of equivalence here between 10 times the Eved and 100 times the Behema. Right, by mine Rabbi Yirmiyah, me Rabbi Asi. So Rabbi Yirmiyah queried of Rabbi Asi. Macharav do mate, ma'u shekansu et beno acharav. He sells his eved, and then he passes away, the previous owner of the eved passes away. Do we penalize his children to go in and redeem the eved based on this takanat chachamim? So now Gemara says, im timtzolo mar tzorim ozin bechor umate kansu beno acharav. In the case where he puts a mum intentionally into a bechor, by putting the mum into the bechor, he wants to do that so that he can monetize the bechor. Because until the bechor gets a mum, it's a bechor tam that has to go on the mizbeach. And the time when there's mikdash is not extant, he can't bring it on the mizbeach. So the only way to monetize this bechor is to have him get a mum, a permanent mum. So this guy decides to put the mum in the bechor in order to monetize it. So then doing that, the chachamim said that there is a takanat chachamim, that if you do that, lo yishachet olamit, you lose him. That's it. You will get no value out of this. Even if he later on gets another mum, this will be pusel him from the ability to be redeemed. And this animal will just live out its life without having anything happen to it. You'll never be able to monetize it. That's the penalty. So now, if we penalize the guy who actually did this, he went ahead and put a mum into the bechor by cutting his ear, and then passes away. His children that now have inherited this bechor, are they subject to that knas? Or are they innocent victims over here? And then if he gets a mum, then they could monetize the animal. The Gemara says here, im tim salomar, if you want to say the conclusion by tzorim ozen bechor, if the conclusion there is that we do penalize the children and say they still can't redeem the bechor, monetize the bechor, that is because mishum di isura d'oraito, because that is a violation of a din d'oraita. Putting a mum into a bechor is a violation of a din d'oraita. Selling an eved to a non-Jew is a violation of a din derabanan. Even though, in some sense, you could equate the two and say that the bechor, having a mum in it, putting the mum in a bechor is an isur d'oraita, selling the eved to the oved kochavim is also, in a sense, din d'oraita, because he's going to violate mitzvot d'oraita by being owned by the oved kochavim. But still, in the true sense of where the problem is, the problem by the bechor is you put the mum there, the problem by the eved kenani is that you're selling him. The act of selling is only a din derabonon versus the tzorim ozin bechor, which is a din d'oraita. Here, Tosafot points out that the Gemara in Bechorot has a slightly different version of this Gemara, but that Gemara in Bechorot also says that Eved has another side to him where it also might be more chamur than bechor, which is this, imtim salom rahatam lo kanso, hacha kanso mishum demafkele mi mitzvot. On the side of the Eved, there's a reason to be more machmir by the Eved than by Bechor, because the Eved, you're mafkioto min ha mitzvot, versus Tzorim Bechor is a one-time Isur, and then the Isur is done. So, again, you could differentiate in both directions. Tosafot says that the Gemara in Bechorot is going in both directions, our Gemara only heading in one direction. But ain't Ochanami, if you're really looking at this, you could have said proposed the question the other way. Even if you say by Bechor that we don't penalize the children, by the sale of the Eved, maybe we should penalize the children, because Eved might be more chamor than Bechor. You could have posed the question either way. The Gemara went in this direction and says, even if you penalize him by the case of Bechor, doesn't mean that necessarily you're going to penalize him by the Eved. Over here, you only have an Isur Derabanan. Over there, a case where an individual left his work to the point where it became a davar aved on Chol HaMoed. One is not allowed to work on Chol HaMoed, except for davar aved, items that would be lost if you don't take care of them on Chol HaMoed itself. So now a person can basically set up a situation in which he procrastinates before Yom Tov and makes it that it will become a davar aved on Chol HaMoed. So the Chamim in that case penalized that individual. He could have weeded his field before Yom Tov, but he says, you know what, I'll time on Yom Tov, because by the time Yom Tov comes, if I don't weed the field then, I'm going to lose my crop. And then it'll be a davar aved, and I'll be able to go out and weed on Yom Tov, and I'll work on Yom Tov. So that's what's called kivein melachto d'moed. He directs the melacha, so it becomes a davar aved, and he has to do it on Chol HaMoed. Over there, the chachamim penalized him and says he may not do the work on Chol HaMoed. They will stop him from doing the work. What happens if he passes away? And now the children inherit this situation, which they are stuck with a field. If they don't deal with it, it's going to be lost on Chol HaMoed. Are we kones the children or not kones the children? So if you say in that case, lo kansu b'no acharav, that they did not penalize the children afterwards, mishom d'lo avidi surah. That's because They didn't do any isur. The children are, again, innocent victims of a situation, yeah. Not the participants in the isur. So then, hocha mai. L'day kansu rabbanan, valete. What is the case here by Evan? Is the case here that they penalized the owner, and he's no longer here? Odimale mimone kansu rabbanan, vaite. Or is the penalty a monetary penalty, and his estate still exists? And the penalty comes out of the estate. It's not a penalty against the individual, but against the estate. What type of penalty? Is it a personal foul, we'll call it a personal penalty? Or is it a monetary penalty, which, again, would outlive the life of the individual who committed the yisur? Amrelei tinitua. It's a mishnah. Sadeh shenikavtza bishvi'it. A field that was cleared of its thorns on shvi'it. Tizara lemotzei shvi'it. May be planted on Motzei Shvi'it. Nitaiva o nidaira. Rashi claims over here, nitaiva means that he fertilized the field. Nidaira is that he set up a corral of animals on the field in order to fertilize it. Lo tizara le Motzei Shvi'it. You may not plant in that field in Motzei Shvi'it. In both cases, there is a violation of Isurim on Shvi'it. In one case, he took the thorns out of the field and prepared the field. The other case, he fertilize the field. Here there are two methods by which he fertilizes the field. In one case, we say he's allowed to plant the field on Motzei Shvi'it. In one case, we say he's not allowed to plant the field on Motzei Shvi'it. Rashi explains the differences. Shinit kavtza ein zu avdat karka min haTorah. This is not considered to be working the land according to the Torah. It's not a direct action on the land, but rather the clearing out of the karka. It's a yipuya karka. It's making the place look nicer. It's improving the... whereas Rashi says, by the case of Nizdavla, that case is direct avoda in the karka. So in the one case, we are not konesim because it's not direct avoda in the karka. In the other case, we are konesim because there wasn't direct work on the karka. So now let's go through each of these items because Tosafot on every one of these items has something to say about it. The first thing about Nitkavtza here, in terms of weeding the fields and taking out the thorns from the fields, he brings from the Rabbeinu Chanan, we're talking about detached thorns, not thorns that are attached to the ground. So that's a distinction that's made in the Gemara in the beginning of Modei Katan. There the Gemara has distinctions between weeding. One case it seems that weeding's okay, one case it's not okay, and they make a differentiation between weeding items where you just simply cut them off, or cases where you uproot them. So similarly over here, the Rabbeinu Chanan is making a similar type of distinction, which is, it's one thing to uproot thorns, which should be the equivalent of odata karka. There you're really preparing the land, you're clearing the land. If you have loose brambles all over the field, which makes it that it's not pleasant to look at, or you can't really use it because the bramble, if you simply pick up the brambles there, it's not necessarily permitted on Shvi'it, but if you do it, it's not real avodata karka because you're simply clearing the land, not physically out of the land, but on top of the land, you're clearing it. That's why it's a less of a problem. That's one thing to note about the nidkavtza. The second thing is, Tosafot disagrees about nitaiva. Rashi says nitaiva is simply fertilizing the land. On the other hand, Tosafot says that cannot be the case because that's an iser derabanan to fertilize the land. It's not an iser deoraita. And over here, we want something that's an iser deoraita because the Gemara in Bechorot compares this to Tzoreim Ozen Bechor and says over there that we're talking about a iser deoraita. So the only way to get to iser deoraita, Tosafot over here says nitaiva. Is Harash Bacharisha Yetera. He plowed the field an additional time, which is an Isar Doraita. That is not so simple either. That is Tosafot Shitato, that Harisha is Doraita on Shvi'it, even though it is a Machloket Rishonim as to whether Harisha is Doraita or not with regards to Shvi'it, because Harisha is not necessarily ever mentioned explicitly with regards to Shvi'it. It seems to be mentioned by Tosefet Shvi'it, not Shvi'it itself. But many of the Rishonim believe that that will be a Kav HaChomer. It's restricted in Tosefet Shvi'it. It must be restricted during Shvi'it itself. But there are other Rishonim that believe Harisha is the Rabbanan. But Tosafot, the Shitato, says Harisha is the Oraita. And therefore, this Nitaiva here is a plowing that is a violation of the Oraita. He does admit in the end that Nidaira only is a Din de Rabbanan, because setting up the corral and having the animals fertilize the field is fertilizing, and fertilizing is only an Isur Derabanan. So what you could argue now is that our Gemara over here is viewing this as Derabanan, Because the Gemara here already was Shulel, the aspect of Doraita, by saying it's not comparable to Bechor, which is Doraita. You have to compare it to Eved, which is a Din Derabanan. Which seemingly means that everything afterwards is a Din Derabanan. Kivei Melachto L'Moed seems to be a Din Derabanan. First of all, that's also controversial. The Gemara itself has Stirot in this, as well as Machloket Rishonim as to whether Melachet Chol HaMoed, doing work on Chol HaMoed, is a Din Doraita or a Din Derabanan. Over here from this Gemara, it seems like it's only a Din Derabanan. Similarly over here, the Gemara here, when it's comparing these dinim of Shvi'it to our case of selling the Eved, again, it's assuming that it's a din derabanan, which would favor Rashi's explanation that we're talking about melachot derabanan and not melachot deoraita. The other hand, Tosafot, by saying one of them, nitaiva, is deoraita, and one of them, nidaira, is derabanan, can say that it fits in our Gemara here, because we'll be speaking about the nidaira aspect, which is the derabanan aspect, and the Gemara Bechorot, which says that this Shvi'it issue is an issue Doraita, will be focusing on the Netaiva aspect, which is a Din Doraita. So the two of them are put together because they're both about improving the field, but one's Doraita, one's Derabanan. Then Tosafot gives another possibility according to Rabbeinu Tam, which says that all of this is Derabanan, except by Shvi'it, Itnan Nahachmir Tvei Mishom Makom Kishayu Mizalzalimba. That even though all of these might be Derabanan, nevertheless, they elevated it to the level of a Doraita in terms of penalties and problems because people didn't keep Shvi'it. People were blatant violators of Shvi'it, and they were mezalza on the Chachamim, so the Chachamim had to really come back with very much stronger takanot in order to protect the Shvi'it. So even though it's considered to be a din derabanan here, nevertheless, we would treat it like a din Doraita because of the necessity of the Chachamim to strengthen the restrictions with regards to Shvi'it. We have concluded from that Mishnah, that in the case where he does this haitava, whether it's according to Tosafot, he plowed the field, according to Rashi, he fertilized the field, then dies, we do allow his child to plant it on Motzei Shvi'it. So there you see that despite the fact that there is a Isur derabanan, a takna derabanan, that would prevent him if he was alive, there's a knas that prevents him from planting the field, nevertheless, we do not pass that down to his child. Alma, what's the conclusion from this? Ledidei kansu rabanan, debrei lo kansu rabanan. The penalty is directed at the individual, the persona himself who did the violation, and not against the money or the estate of that individual. So same thing over here, you would argue, that the penalty is on the person that sold the slave, not on his estate. Samar baye, naktinan. And here we have an additional case like this. Timei ta'arot shel chavero umeit. Person who is mitamei, makes tamei the ta'arot of his friend, and then dies. Lo kansu rabbanan beno achara. Rabbanan did not penalize the child afterwards. My taima. Hezek sheinu nikar lo shmei hezek. When it comes to doing damage that is not visible damage, technically min haTorah, that is not damage. Over here, when you're mitamei something, when you look at the produce that's here, when it was Tamei or not Tamei, it looks exactly the same. That's Hezek Sheinu Nikar. The Hezek is that you now made it Tamei. And in making it Tamei, he can't utilize it for certain things. Or if it's Truma, it's no longer edible. This is Hezek that isn't visible, but has monetary impact on the individual. That there is no obligation in a Torah to pay for it. But nevertheless, Knosa Derabonan he. So there, it's a Knas Derabonan where you have to pay for Hezek Sheinu Nikar. The today kansu rabbanan, the brelo kansu rabbanan. Here again, we have the same din, which is that they penalize the individual himself and not his children that come afterwards. And in our case too, the Gemara here simply wants to conclude that the eved, the sale of the eved, is a penalty against the one who sold the eved, not a penalty against the estate, and therefore the children should be exempted. In all of these cases, as Tosafot points out, you can go back to the Gemara in Bechorot and say that eved in all these cases is different. Because Eved is mafkia uto mina mitzvot. You are taking him away from mitzvot. So even though the conclusion here of the Gemara is that the penalty is against the person, not against the estate, made by Bay Eved, we would distinguish or differentiate because of the fact that you're mafkia mina mitzvot, and maybe we would obligate the estate. Again, our Gemara seemingly concludes that you are not obligating the estate, but based on the Gemara in Bechorot and that statement that it makes, it's a possibility that you could argue despite all of these conclusions, Eved might still be different than all the examples that we brought over here. One other case where there is a difference is in a case where a person lent with interest, which is against the Torah. It's a violation of a din d'oraita to lend with interest. Over there, the Rabbi Meir was kones the individual that not only does he lose the interest, he loses the entire contract or the entire debt, repayment of the debt. So in that case, does that penalty apply to the children as well, where he dies? Do the children not able to collect the debt, or are they able to collect the debt? Over there we say they are not able to collect the debt, which makes it sound like the estate is penalized. Tosafot says that's not the case, because the penalty is that the loan is basically forgiven. And that already happened in the lifetime of the individual. Once he lent with rebate, the outstanding debt doesn't exist anymore. So then when the children come, there's nothing to return, or there's no claim left, because the knas already eliminated the possibility of collection in that case. The other case is a case between a machlok between Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim, where two people deposited money with an individual. One gave 200, one gave 100. They both come back now and they say the 200 is mine. So in that case, what do you do? So the Chachamim say, you give 100 back to each one, because we know for sure 100 belongs to them. And the last 100 you keep, and say, Amotzi mechaver olav araya, we leave it with the court until Yavo Eliyahu, and will tell us which one it belongs to. Rabbi Yossi says, Imkein ma hifsid ramai. What does the cheater lose in that situation? His downside is getting his money back. His upside is that they believe him and he gets 200. So Rabbi Yossi says you leave all of the money at Shavu Eliyahu. That way the Ramai has downside, which is that he has to take into consideration if they don't believe him, then he's going to lose his 100 that he really put in there. So we know he's owed 100, and that might compel him to tell the truth, because then he's going to lose all of his money. So over there as well, when the person dies, do we then allow the child to collect 100? Because we were penalizing him because we wanted to compel him to tell the truth. But now that he's dead, maybe the child should collect it. So Tosfot again over here says the child cannot collect it, because then in a sense you've defeated the purpose of the penalty according to Rabbi Yossi. The whole reason for the penalty is that he'll admit to get his money back. If he knows he'll get his money back when he dies and his children will get it, then he's not really compelled. Again, his downside is my kids get the money. My upside is I get the extra money. So therefore, it defeats the purpose of the Takanat Chachamim to give it to the children. So in those cases, Tosafot says that the children do not get to collect the money. So he gives those two examples as being exceptions to the rule rather than determinants of the rule. And that's why they're not brought as examples over here. But again, the conclusion is that the penalty is on the individual, not on the estate. And again, you could, based on the Gemara in Bechorot, differentiate the case of Evet. All right, now, oh, the Chutz Haaretz. He sells them out to Chutz Haaretz. Tanu Banan. Mocher avdo l'chutz haaretz, yetza l'cheirut. Tzarech get shichrur migrobo asheni. When you sell him to go to chutz haaretz, the eved goes free, and he needs a document of emancipation from his second owner. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel omer, pamim yetza, upamim lo yetza. Sometimes he does go free, sometimes he does not go free. Keitzad. Amar ploni avdi, micharti uleponi antochi. He says that I sold my slave to so-and-so, the Antochi, which means that he's someone from Antochia, which was a very large non-Jewish city in northern Syria. In the time of the Gemara, it was major city, a central location that probably because of the land bridge between Europe and the Middle East over there, that became a major city. This individual comes from Antochia, I sold it to him. Lo yatsa. In that case, he doesn't go free. Antochi shib Antochia. I sold him to this individual from Antochi who lives in Antochia, Yatsa. Then he goes out free. What Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says is it depends on the nature of the sale. If he sold him in such a manner where it's obvious that the eved is going to Chutz Laaretz, then in that case, we penalize him and he goes free. In another case, if he sells him in such a manner that the description of the individual is simply that he came from Antochi, means that it's an identifying character trait of this individual, but not necessarily an indication that he's taking him back to Antochia. So in that case, we will not penalize and say that he's yatsa, that he goes free. Now the truth is, so now in this instance, it's a little difficult to understand the Gemara, because what you would have assumed is, let's look at the result. Did he get taken to Chutz Laaretz? He didn't get taken to Chutz Laaretz. And then we'll know what to do in this case. So what you can say, or what you have to say here, is that the seller, it makes assumptions when he sells him to an individual. He doesn't check if he's taking him to Chutz Laaretz, not taking him to Chutz Laaretz. He's just selling him, and he finds a Jew that wants to buy him. Now, how much should he have known that this guy might take him to Chutz Laaretz? If the contract already says that he sold to so-and-so, the Antochi, who lives in Antochia, then he's got to know that the Eved is going to Chutz Laaretz, because the guy lives there. And so obviously, if he's buying it, he's going to take him. The document just says that it sold to so-and-so, the Antochi. That doesn't mean that he lives in Antochia. This means that he came from Antochia. Just like you would sell, if I sell it to so-and-so the American, doesn't mean that he lives in America. It just means that he came from America. He may live somewhere else. Now, Va'atanyo, don't we have a braita? V'charti lantochi yatsa. Lantochi asharui belod lo yatsa. If he sells him to an antochi, then he goes free. If he sells him to the antochi that lives in Lod, which is inside of Eretz Yisrael, then lo yatsa. So now what you have here is a difference in the default status. In the first case, by Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, it seems that the default status is that the person lives in Eretz Yisrael, unless you specify otherwise. In the case of the Braita, the assumption is that he lives in Chutz Laaretz, unless you specify otherwise. So how do we reconcile between these two Braitas? Lo kasha. Hadidle beita b'Eretz Yisrael. That is, if he has a house in Eretz Yisrael. Hadidle ushpiza b'Eretz Yisrael. He has a bed and breakfast. He has a rental in Eretz Yisrael. So in the case where he has a house in Eretz Yisrael, it's a good assumption that if he buys it, he's staying in Eretz Yisrael. And there the default will be that even if he says antochi, that he's staying in Eretz Yisrael because he has a house, he has a place to live here. And therefore, only if he specifies other words, which is the antochi shem antochia, then do we penalize him and say he's yetzah d'cherut. In the other case, if he does not have a house here, he's just temporarily being here, or he has an ushpiza, then the default status is he's going back home. Home means back to antochia. Then unless he specifies otherwise, we assume that he's selling him the chutz laaretz, unless he specifies that he's staying specifically in Eretz Yisrael. Up to a point, we're not asking you to go and do background checks and figure out everything like that. The question is, can you make reasonable assumptions? The guy owns a house in Israel, it's a reasonable assumption without doing a lot of investigation, that he probably is going to keep the evid here. If he doesn't have a house here, in all likelihood, he's taking him back. Now again, there are all different types of cases where it may be different. It's a reasonable assumption in these cases, for someone who owes a place in that manner. By Rabbi Yirmiyah, Ben Bavel, Shenasa Isha Be'eretz Yisrael. Person who came from Bavel, that marries a woman in Eretz Yisrael, V'chnisa lo avadim ushfachot, and she brings into the marriage slaves and maidservants, V'dato lachzor, and his clear intent is to go back to Bavel. So she marries him, he's a Ben Bavel, knowing that she's going back with him to Bavel. What is the din here? Tibai lamanda amar adinima, tibai lamanda amar adinimo. The question comes up both according to one who says that we favor her in the decision here, as well as the one that says that we favor him in the decision over here. The question is that a baal, when he takes property from his wife, as Rashi says over here, baal b'nichsei ishto lokeach chavi. A baal is considered to be a buyer of his wife's property. If that's the case, you basically sold your eved into chutz laaretz. Because by giving him to the Baal, the Baal now owns him, and the Baal is going to Bavel. So it's equivalent of selling your Eved or your Shifcha Knanit to go to Chutz Laaretz, and so therefore maybe there should be a penalty over here, so Yatzah L'Cherut. Now the Gemara says, well, there is a difference here. When a woman brings in Nichsei Belog, first of all, they still belong to her, so there's no sale there. In the case where it's Nichson Son of Arzel, Nichson Son of Arzel are evaluated for their value when they're brought into the marriage, and the husband is obligated to make whole on that value, not necessarily return the item itself. The Gemara there has a machloka with regards to certain things like fields, and Eved, the Shifcha, who are still extant at the end of the marriage. And now the Baal says, I'll pay you the money equivalent, because that's the obligation that I accepted myself. I'll keep the Eved, I'll do what I want with the Eved, I'll do what I want with the Sadeh. I'm only obligated to pay you the value, not these objects themselves. There the Gemara has a machloka whether Adinimo, he's right. He's only obligated to pay the price, and whatever that price is, that's what he pays, and he can keep the avadim. There's another daya that says a dinima, that the din goes with her, and she can demand the avadim back, or demand the sadeh back, assuming that that's equal to the value that he had placed in there. Right. The reason being what's called shevach beit avia. These are heirlooms of the family, and she doesn't want to lose them. If they're extant at that time, she has a right, or a first right of refusal to take them rather than monetary value. So now, the Gemara says, you can ask the question according to both opinions there. You can ask according to one who says that she has a right to keep these avadim. We say, since the din is with her, they're like hers. Or maybe because, even though they're quote-unquote hers, nevertheless, in the interim period, they're for his to use. Since they're his to use, maybe they become like his in the interim. It's as if there was a sale to go to Chutz Laaretz. The question would apply even if you believe that he is the true owner of these items here. Do we say since the din is with him, they're like his? Or maybe since he didn't really acquire them for their goof itself, he's just entitled to utilize them and use them at this point, then he doesn't have real ownership over here, so he didn't really acquire them. So despite the fact that the dini mo, it might be that the woman still has some first rights of refusal here in taking back this evid or this sadeh versus taking compensation in lieu, which is that if he's going to sell them anyway or monetize them anyway, then she might be the party that has that first right of refusal. Or in a case where he wants to pay her with shove kesef, items that are not money itself, then she could refuse that payment and say, I want those items back unless you give me cash. So since the woman has a certain amount of rights or rights of refusal here, again, if the husband passes away, she can take them back. That might be enough ownership that it's not deemed to be a full sale to the husband over here. Gemara leaves that as a teiku, an unresolved issue. So by getting married, does the woman in effect sell these slaves to her husband? And if it is deemed to be a sale, then it'd be like selling them to go to Chutz Laaretz. If it's not deemed to be a sale, they're still in her possession. And therefore, they have not been sold out to Eretz Yisrael. There might be a separate issue when she herself goes out to Chutz Laaretz where the slaves can say, we don't want to go with you, because they have a right to demur at that time. But at the time of the Nisuin, when they're still in Eretz Yisrael, at that moment, is there effectively a transaction that took place which would free them immediately rather than only when they actually do go back to Bavel? Then, of course, they would have another chance to demur and say, we don't want to go to Chutz Laaretz, and they could gain their freedom in that way. Amar Rabbi Abba, Shana li Rabbi Yochanan, Eved sheyatzah achar rabo l'Suria. If an Eved follows his master out to Suria, umicharo sham rabo, and then his master sells him over there, Yatzada Cherut, he goes out free. Gemara says, V'hatani Rabbi Chia, don't we have a brighter from Mechia? Ibeidet Zchuto. The Eved loses his right, because he went out with him to Chutz Laaretz. This goes to your question, which is, what is the nature of the Eved leaving Eretz Yisrael? Lo Kasha. Kansha dat Rabo Lachzor. Kansha in dat Rabo Lachzor. Difference is, what was the intent of the master when he went out to Suria? If he goes out with the intent of returning to Eretz Yisrael, it's only a temporary leave from Eretz Yisrael, then when the Evan follows him out there, it's as not as if he acquiesced to go to Chutz Laaretz. He thought he was coming back to Eretz Yisrael because his master was coming back as well. Temporary visits to Chutz Laaretz are not a problem, and they're not a problem for the Evan Kanani as well. It's not as if he's saying, I'm willing to live in Chutz Laaretz. So therefore, he can then say when the master sells him, and that's going to be permanently entrenched him in Chutz Laaretz, then the Evan goes free because he has a right then to say, I don't want to remain in Chutz Laaretz, or there's a penalty for leaving him in Chutz Laaretz. On the other hand, if the Eved willingly went out with the master, knowing that the master had no intent of returning to Eretz Yisrael, that means that the Eved already accepted the fact that he will be in Chutz Laaretz. And since he didn't demur then to not go out to Chutz Laaretz, then when he goes out, he already put himself in Chutz Laaretz. If then the master sells him to remain in Chutz Laaretz, nothing's changed. He's in Chutz Laaretz willingly, and he will remain in Chutz Laaretz. There should be no penalty in that case. And that's the difference between Rabbi Yochanan's din and the din of Rabbi Chia. Batanyo, and there, Batanyo's not a question, but Rashi says, Benichuta, that Batanyo's supportive of what we just said. You'd say, Ha'eved achar rabo l'Suria. An Eved can go out with his master to Suria. Gemara says, you'd say, he has to go out with him? Losagi de lo nofik? What do you mean? He could say, I don't want to go. And he has a right to do that, Vatanan, because we have a Mishnah. Veino kol motzim can't compel an Eved or Shivcha to go to Chutz Laaretz. He can make a demand to stay in. So the language in the Braita cannot be correct, which is Yotzei Eved. The Eved is compelled to go with his master to Chutz Laaretz. That's just not true. Ella, Yotza Eved, Achar Rabo to Suria. If he follows his master out to Suria, Umecharo Rabo Sham, and then his master sells him there, Imdat Rabo Lachzor, if the intent of his master is to return kofinoto, then we compel him to free him or to bring him back. If his master had no intent of returning to Eretz Yisrael, in kofinoto, then we don't force the freedom for the slave because he agreed to go to Chutz La'aretz. If he already agreed to go to Chutz La'aretz, it seemingly is not an impediment to him going out. And if it's not an impediment, if he sells him there and leaves him there, then it's no different than his status was when he left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz, and we won't intervene on his behalf. This is the latter half of that braita, which is obviously supportive of the distinction we made as to the intent of the Baal when the Eved goes out, that will impact on his sale in Chutz La'aretz. The Gemara interrupted the braita because the word Yotzei didn't make any sense. So it fixed that by amending the braita to say Yatzah, but then it goes on to give you the remainder of the braita, which is supportive of the distinction that we made before. I heard two things from Shmuel. Chadahach, one of them was this, Chirat Eved to Chutz La'aretz, selling an Eved out to Chutz La'aretz. Ve'idach, Ditmar. And the other one was this. Mocher Sadeo B'Shnat HaYovel, Atzma. Someone who sells a field on the Yovel itself. Rav Amar Mechura V'Yotza. Rav says, it's sold and it immediately goes back to the Baalim. It immediately returns to the person who sold it because the rule of the Yovel is, all property goes back to the original owner. So Rav says the sale is a good sale, just the land goes right back to him. Shmuel Amar, Eina Mechura Kol Ikar. There's no sale over here, because basically it's a Kal V'Chomer, which is, if what is sold already returns, then certainly something that is not sold should not be able to be sold on the Yovel, and there is no sale over here. B'chada Hadre Zvine. In one case, we reverse the transaction. U'b'chada Lo Hadre Zvine. In one case, we do not reverse the transaction, and it stands, meaning that the money is lost. I don't know which one is which. Amar of Yosef, next day Amar. Let us try to deduce from different materials what was the position of Shmuel. Meditani bebraita. We have a statement in a braita. Amucher avdol lechutz la'aretz. Someone who sells his eved to chutz la'aretz, yatsa lecherut. He goes free, but he needs a document of emancipation from his second owner. You see here that the transaction was successful and cannot be reversed. The only reason you would need a document of emancipation from the second owner is because the transaction was effective, and the second owner now owns him, and that's why you need a get shichrur. Otherwise, if you believe that the transaction didn't go through, then you would need a get shechrur, a document of emancipation from his first master, not from his second master. The fact that you do says that. V'chi amar shmo otam enu mechuar, mechura, and from that you would conclude that in the case of Yovel, he says that the transaction is unwound. I mean, enu mechura means the field does not go through, the sale does not go through at all. Uma'ot chozrim. And the money is refunded. So the Gemara says, first of all, Rav Anan, Braita lo Shmuel. And the reason that Rav Anan had this question about which statement of Shmuel was a transaction that's not reversed versus a transaction that is reversed, the reason he didn't know that is that he hadn't heard that Braita. But once Rav Yossi brought the Braita, it becomes clear that the view is that by the Eved, the transaction goes through, and then there's a penalty. Versus here, where the transaction is unwound by the Yovel. Now, Rashi points out over here, if Shmuel believes that the transaction is unwound, then what's the difference between Rav and Shmuel's opinion? Rav says the sale goes through, and then the field comes right back to him. Shmuel says the transaction doesn't go through, so the field stays with him. So the difference might be the money, which we're going to see in 1 second. The Gemara is going to discuss what happens to the money. The other thing will, whether it's deemed a sale or not. According to Rav, there was a sale, and then the land comes back. According to Shmuel, there was never a sale. The difference is a kinyan agav. If he was kone something, agav the karka. So he bought the karka, and along with it, he took metaltalim, which is a kinyan agav, which says that you can acquire metaltalim with the karka, even though the kinyan is not a kinyan for metaltalim. But along with the sale of the karka, they're drawn along. For Rav, there was really a mechira over here. And since there was a mechira, the kinyan goes through, even though he has to return the property right away afterwards. So he sells him the land with the tractor, and he says the kinyan you make on the land will be effective for the tractor as well. So that kinyan agav works if there's a mechira over here. Rav says there is a mechira. Shmuel says that the land comes back, but there's no mechira. That means that there was no kinyan for the land, there's no kinyan for the tractor as well. So there's no kinyan agav. So that, Rav, she says, will be a nafkamina if you say that Shmuel says the transaction is unwound. The other nafkamina is about the money, which the Gemara is about to discuss. What happens to the money when you unwind the transaction? So the Gemara says, V'i mid Shmuel, How do you know that the transactions are unwound and the money comes back? Maybe it is that the transactions are unwound, but we deem the money to be a gift. It's similar to the case where a person tries to do kiddushin with his sister, which clearly doesn't work. Rav says, it's clear that the kiddushin doesn't work, and you get your money back because the kiddushin failed. On the other hand, Shmuel Amar ma'ot matana, that the ma'ot are a gift in that case, because everybody knows that you can't marry your sister. And since he knows that, when he gave the money, he gave it as a gift. He just called it kiddushin so his sister would accept it instead of being a matana. Based on that, he would say that there's a possibility that the ma'ot remain in place. Now, Tosfot says, Lufi Emet, there's a reason to be mechalek between the case of kiddushin and the case of Yovel. And that is because by Kiddushin, everybody knows you can't marry your sister, and therefore it's obvious, and that's why Shmuel says it's a matana. By the case of Yovel, it's not obvious that you can't sell your land during the Yovel, but Raya that Rav thinks you can sell your land during the Yovel. So since not everybody knows over there, you can't say automatically it is a matana. And so Tosafot says, despite the fact that the Gemara over here compares the cases, there is room to be mechalek between the cases and say that it's not proper evidence from Mekadesh et Achoto. But nevertheless, what the Gemara does say is it's not clear here, according to Shmuel, that just because the transaction is unwound, that you get your money back. There's a possibility that you lose your money because we deem them a gift, and therefore you don't get your money back. So that's all he's clarifying over here. And again, that would be a nafkamina again between Rav and Shmuel. If you say that Rav says it's a mechira and the land comes back right away, then the money is gone. According to Shmuel, if you unwind the transaction, if you unwind the transaction and say the money is a gift, then in the end it's the same thing. The land comes back, the money goes, and you have to say the nafkamina of Rashi. On the other hand, if you say that the transaction is unwound and the money comes back, that would be a difference between Shmuel and Rav. In both cases, the seller would get the property back, but in one case, the buyer would get his money back, and that's the case of Shmuel. In the case of Rav, he would not get his money back, and that would also be a nafkamina between that shita of Rav and Shmuel. Amar le Baile Rav Yosef. Why are we penalizing the buyer and not the seller? The seller is the one here who sold the Eved to Chutz La'aretz. So then why are we penalizing the Lokeach and saying that we then free the slave and compel him to give a get shechur? Why don't we just simply say that the Mocher is penalized over here? And I guess we would compel him to buy back the Eved or do something to free the Eved. So he says, Amalei, lav achra ganav, elachora ganav. The reason is, it's not the mouse that steals, rather the hole that steals. Because unless the Eved goes somewhere, then there is no reason to penalize. So over here, the Lokeach is the problem. The Lokeach is the one who's taking him to Chutz La'aretz. The Lokeach, in the end, is the one who takes him away from where he needs to be. And therefore we're going to penalize the Lokeach and not the Mocher. So he responds to him and says, based on your mashal, it's very nice that you think that the hole steals, but the hole itself can't steal. If you don't have a mouse, nothing's going to end up inside of the hole. Without a seller, you don't have a buyer. Or in the end, what seems here is that the Gemara clearly thinks that the seller here is more culpable. So then why are we penalizing the lokeach? The Gemara's answer is, Mistabra hechadika yisura atum kansinon. Wherever the Isur sits, that's where we penalize. The Eved now sits with the Lokeach, sits with the buyer. And that's why we're going to penalize him. Enochanami, the seller here is the more responsible party. But because the Eved sits with the Lokeach now, that's where we can impose the penalty. And that's the easier place for us to impose the penalty. Therefore, we penalize the buyer, even though maybe in a sense the Mocher is more responsible. For that reason, some Rishonim believe that if he sells the Eved and the Eved is still with the Mocher, that we penalize the Mocher and free him then, instead of going after the Lokeach, and then we'll force the Mocher either to buy him back or reverse the transaction. Other Rishonim say, no, that's not the case. The penalty is always on the Lokeach. And even though maybe the Mocher is more responsible, the penalty was imposed on the Lokeach. When he's in the possession of the Lokeach, that's when we'll impose the fine or the Knas that is over here. Okay, we'll stop here by the two dots in the top of Memhei Amud Aleph.